sometimes the injustice is not obvious. I want you to take a look at the case of John Poindexter and the case of Oliver North. Casper Weinberg, goodness, just indicted. Iran-Contra's not over yet. To date, the only successful prosecution as a prosecution was of John Poindexter. Now, Poindexter's case got reversed on appeal, but it was the only case where there was a solid, clean finding of fact and serious punishment, and the case was tried by Dan Webb. I want to tell you a little bit about that case because it identified the job of the lawyer in pointing out the wrong to be righted, which the American people had a lot of trouble understanding. Now, the press made tremendous amounts out of Iran-Contra. Do you recall what it was all about? Well, you see, and maybe you never knew, a lot of the press never really understood. Time magazine had a headline that said, "Confused about Iran-Contra? So is Ronald Reagan." That was one of their headlines. And the people were confused because the way the press dribbled it out and played everything so big without putting it into the context of what it's all about. Here's what it was about. We had the Sandinistas and the Contras, and Reagan wanted to support the anti-communist movement, the Contras. And Congress said, wait a minute. These Contras, they may be death squads. They may not just be anti-communist. And Congress said, look, President, no more money to these darn Contras. And they passed the Boland Amendment that said, no U.S. money goes to the Contras. But money kept going to the Contras. How did it get there? Well, it was a combination of the National Security Advisor, the CIA, and other organizations and private individuals that were laundering money in Washington and sending it to the Contras. A violation of the Boland Amendment, but guess what? The Boland Amendment is not a criminal statute, and sending money to the Contras was not a criminal offense. And Congress, finding that money was going to the Contras, and the press was down there looking at the Contras with their new weapons and say, hey, they got new weapons. Wonder where they came from. Congress says, we better find out. And they have a hearing. And in the hearings, they're lied to. Okay? They are lied to in the hearing. And then the National Security Advisor figures everything's home free. Ollie North figures everything's home free. And at the last minute, it is discovered, because a couple of pieces of paper were not destroyed, Iran-Contra broke wide open. And now we have the second set of hearings that were nationally televised. And now Ollie North admits that he had lied to Congress. Okay. Congress was all agog. Congress took Oliver North, who was a middle-level military bureaucrat, whose job it was to slink around Washington, launder money, and lie to Congress. They took this guy, and they made him a hero. Now, only Congress could do that. Why? Well, first of all, the American people said, lying to Congress, what's the big deal? We pay them to lie to us. How could this be a crime? And then Ollie North, squeaky clean, nice short haircut, honest as the day is long, frankly admitting everything, correcting them when they made mistakes. He knew every jot and tittle. He crossed every T. He dotted every I. He knew it all. And he was frank and forthcoming. And he said, I was just a loyal American doing my job. It was in my job description. It was in my military occupational specialty, what the Army calls the MOS, to lie to Congress. Your description? Why? Okay, that's my job. And you know what? He sold that. Partly because his lawyer, Brendan Sullivan, did such a beautiful job. And the American people never understood what Iran-Contra was about. They thought that because Congress had made a law that somehow putting money down there was illegal and bad. You should go to jail for that.
What?
It was a fiscal rule, fiscal statute. You can't spend any money on this, but it didn't have any criminal teeth. Of course, if it turned out that Ronald Reagan was knowingly violating that fiscal rule, that could seriously damage his presidency. And that's what Congress is out to do. They took this and they tried to humiliate the president with it, which is why the whole thing got muddied. Now then comes the prosecutions. And when Ollie North is prosecuted, he is given a slap on the wrist. The only things he's found guilty of, about the 20 or 25 counts he's indicted with, are when he deliberately, on his own hook and not having been instructed, when he voluntarily lied. He was found guilty of 3 counts of that. Minor thing. And then on appeal, he beat it all. John Poindexter, the National Security Advisor, was tried by Dan Webb. Dan Webb, former U.S. attorney, head of Winston & Strawn's litigation department in Chicago, appointed as the special prosecutor, says, how am I going to prosecute John Poindexter? The guy who was in the White House, the guy who lied to Congress and instructed Ollie North to lie to Congress. He says, I can prove it with paper, but that's an awful way to prove a case. And so he called Ollie North to prove the case against his old boss. Now, here is this big swirl, and I've gone through the facts for you very quickly. This is what it's all about. Lying to Congress and obstructing Congress is a crime. 5 counts, that's all. Poindexter was not over-indicted. And in opening statement, Dan Webb explained what the case was all about simply and directly in just a few minutes. And in final argument, he understood that he had to explain why it's a crime to lie to Congress. When you read his final argument, it makes you proud to be an American. He explains how simple and straightforward the system is. Congress is charged with making laws. That's their job. And to make laws, they need to find out what's happening. And so they are given the power to do inquiries, to make fact-finding missions, to find out what's happening. Their whole work is dependent on getting facts and getting them straight. You see, if you can lie to Congress, then our whole system of government breaks down. That's why it's a crime. That's what he said. You see, he sold the criminality of lying to Congress simply, openly, directly, not condescending, but very straightforward, so that the jury understood it in an instant. He tried the entire Iran-Contra case with 75 documents, no more. There were hundreds of thousands of documents. But Dan Webb whittled it down to 75, and he used Ollie North as an adverse witness to show the deliberate lying to Congress, and he explained why it was wrong. Because he understood that if the jury didn't think it was wrong, no matter what the proof said, there was going to be no conviction. But once the jury understood why it was wrong, that cleared the way for their finding. He was found guilty on all 5 counts. It was reversed on appeal, not having anything to do with the merits of the case, having to do only with the grant of immunity that had been given to North and other witnesses. And the determination by the appellate court that the testimony at the trial violated the grant of immunity. That's why Poindexter's case was reversed on appeal. As a shining example of a great trial lawyer trying the case the right way, Dan Webb shows us how to do it. He shows how to take an adverse witness and make a case with an adverse witness. And he shows how to argue a case so that you sell the injustice of what the defendant did. Okay, that's what lawyering is all about. Shaping the case was not only deciding what are the facts and proof and what does the cause of action require, but what do I really need to convince them of? And he really needed to convince them that it was wrong to lie to Congress. It was pivotal. All right. And now I want you to turn the page and I want you to go ahead into story, the story of the case, how people process information. As you see, our directions of how we push and how we shape and what we need to do and what we need to sell and how we need to sell it, that's given direction by the sense of injustice and by the fact that judges and juries want to undo injustices. And what it is that we need to explain, what it is we need to get across. And sometimes it's just the fact and the injustice is so obvious when you got a killing, when you got a deliberate injury of another person. But there are sometimes when the fact of the offense itself needs to be understood. And if not, they won't find him guilty if they don't think it's wrong. Why? Because they think it's more important to do the right thing than the legally correct thing. Okay, now you need to focus on how do people process information. The law is based on one of the most absurd myths that you can conjure up. The absurd myth is that the unbiased, impartial finders of fact, there are no unbiased, impartial people in the world. All right, so that's fantasy number one. That this unbiased, impartial body of finders of fact will hear all of the proof on an extended trial that may take days, weeks, nay, months, and in Bellevue, 4 years, and the Monsanto case, and reserve judgment until the end. Oh, no. We mustn't decide the case before we have heard all the facts. The judge has told us that. And so we will hear these things and form no opinions and come to no conclusions until we've heard it all and then the final argument. And then we will finally be turned loose to come up with the right conclusion. And the law is based on the outrageous myth that people can even try to do this and that it will work. Wrong. That does not take into account how you and I or anyone else processes information. We don't process information by looking at the fact and reserving judgment. Despite your professional training, you start forming judgments right away. Your professional training leads you to be able to reassess as new facts unfold, to recompute it as you learn additional information. That's what your professional training does. The unprofessionally trained fact finders don't have that ability, and they tend to make up their mind as soon as they think they understand the basic story. The truth of the matter is that they create simple storylines about the facts that they hear. Those storylines explain the phenomena. The storylines are pre-existing scripts that they have in their own minds from their own life experience. They use their life experience to create a story, to create a plot in which there are characters and motives and conduct. And once they think they've got the story straight, they may not hear, well, they physically hear, but they may not register and process contrary information. This is not just jurors. This is all people. Now, the story is essentially important. Let me say that again. The story is essential, important to everything that we learn from the dawn of time. How do you think the first caveman who used a spear explained it to the other cave people? With a little story, maybe a dance, grabbing the spear, holding it, pretending to be the saber-toothed tiger, or pretending to be the bear, or the woolly mammoth, and then showing how he held the spear, told the story. We have used the story from the dawn of time to relate information to other people. The story is built into the creature. We use it to create our sense of morality, to pass on rights and duties and information. We use the story to entertain. We use the story to make sense out of our own lives. Our own lives are, after all, hodgepodges, mixtures of facts and events that it's difficult to make sense out of unless you create grouping, artificial grouping, that you pull together and express as stories. The very structure of our brains and the operation of those brains seems to command stories. They're how we process information. I want you to understand that. I want you to realize that's how stories work. It makes you think about how you present the theory of the case, the story of the case, in an engaging way that can be quickly understood. Let me give you a couple of little examples about things that are important, like point B on page 14. People's life experiences create scripts that explain how things happen. Now, I said that real fast just a couple of minutes ago. You'll remember that. I say, we've all got scripts in our minds, stories that are based on our own life experiences with which we judge the plausibility of the facts that we're hearing. Well, that's like the kid speeding up the kid rather than trying to slow down the truck. That's part of the plausibility factor there. Let me give you another one. The tight security case. In the tight security case, there is a convenience store customer who gets into an argument with a rent-a-cop, a security guard. And there's a tussle, and the security guard's gun goes off, and the customer is shot, and he sues the security guard company, and he sues the convenience store. And the real issue is, was it the customer's fault for being irascible and starting a fight with the security guard, or is it the security guard's fault because of his nature and his training and his conduct? And the plaintiffs say the facts are one way, and the defendant says the facts are another way, and now you've got a question of whom do you believe? Now, you know that that judge has got one set of biases, and you know that a jury will have many sets of biases because of their background. And it really depends on your background. I went to Atwater School in Shorewood, suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Kindergarten, we had Miss Blum. She was a nice lady, little rotund, gray hair. She loved kids. One of the games that we would play was designed to teach us traffic safety. We would walk around in a circle, and she would be the policeman, and she'd put on her police cap, and she'd hold up a little sign that said, stop or go. It was two circles on tongue depressors, and one side was red and said stop, and the other side was green and said go. And when the green sign was up, you would walk around in a circle, and when they turned the red sign, you would stop. And you would learn to obey the policeman, whose job it was to help little boys and girls across the street. And I learned to love the police because of Miss Blum. That was my mindset. I'd never seen a cop roust a drunk. I'd never seen a cop slap somebody up against the side of the head for looking at him cross-eyed. I'd never seen a cop give somebody a hard time because of his ethnic background or his color. I had never experienced that. My life experience was, cops are there to help me. How could you possibly dislike them? They protect you. My life experience and learning since then has taught me that there's another side to that. That sometimes, not always, and I don't want to judge police by the fact that the job tends to attract some people who like to roust other folks. That's true. It also attracts people who want to do the right thing. There are good cops and bad cops, and we know it. And when we categorize them all one way or the other way, we know we're being wrong. But wait, everybody's got a mindset. And the kid who grows up in the ghetto and whose first experience with a cop is seeing somebody roused his father for no good reason has a mindset that is burned back there for all time. And his predisposition about whether this was the hire a gun's fault or the customer's fault is going to be shaped by that life experience. And you have to learn how to tell the story of the case so that it will appeal to that inner script. And you have to understand in jury selection that there are some scripts that you want out of there and that you may not be able to get them all out, that you're probably going to have a representation anyway. And so you have to learn how to appeal to the other scripts that people have. And if this fits into the wrong basic script, how do you pull it out of there and make it fit the right one? Because all of us have multiple scripts. That's what our job is understanding how these predetermined attitudes shape the reaction that folks have and that they're likely to pick a story right at the beginning. And if they do, that may be it. We're going to talk about how it is it. It's not that they decide the case then. We're going to talk about how they take sides later on. I just want you to understand that scripts are there. Okay? Now then, if you believe with me, if you're with me so far, and I hope you are, that stories are key, that stories are what it's all about, that stories are how we learn, that stories are how we understand. If you're there with me, you got to learn a lot about stories. You got to care about stories. You got to study stories. You have to study about what is inherently plausible and what's not inherently plausible. You have to learn how to tell them. Have you noticed how the winning trial lawyers, the ones who have this desire to communicate so effectively, are often engaging about and how they love to tell certain stories that other folks like to listen to, and how it ought to be your job to take over that role? One of the things that you want to do. Here are elements of a story. Stories have beginnings and endings. They're artificial assemblages of facts. You're the one that determines where it starts and where it ends. Oh, the law of relevance has a lot to do with it. But come on, folks. You're the one that traces cause back as far as relevance will let you go and determine where in this stream you want to start. And where you start ought to be dictated not by a theoretical abstract sense of relevance, but of your sense of relevance and how you construct the story so that it causes the identification and the understanding that you're after. Your starting point's important. And you're the one that gets to pick what it is. You can start right at the event, or you can go back at some of the antecedent causes so that they understand the history and the motives. And whether you do one or the other depends on how you decide. Somebody who understands the power of the story, how you decide what's the better place to start. Because this is an art. There's no one right answer to it. There never is. It's an art. All right. It's got a setting and a time and a place. A setting and time. Ladies and gentlemen, the time when the economy of the airlines went sour. Now, if you're dealing with an airline, and that for us means, and then you give it a date, now already the fact finder is oriented toward an economic crunch that may be pivotal to how this particular story, maybe it's a labor dispute with some airline employee and a labor union, an inadequate representation, or maybe unfair labor practice. But identifying it in time and place, one of the most important things you could do would be to set the economic time as well. What about the physical place? That's often important. There's a place on the shoreline of Cleveland. Shoreline has got a shoreline drive that follows the lake. And it comes to a point that the media calls Dead Man's Curve. Now, your opponent may try and get that out with a motion in limine. Maybe they'll be successful, maybe they're not. But just saying, this is something that happened at Dead Man's Curve here in Cleveland, already starts to tell the story. How you articulate the time and place makes a big difference. And stories have beginnings and endings. They have characters. The characters are the people who make a difference. They're the ones who do things. Character. Things happen. Number four. A story is never stasis. It's never static. Things happen. Why do things happen? Juries pay particular attention to motive. They know that interest, bias, prejudice are what really drive people to do what they do. And that if they understand somebody's agenda, they're likely to believe that they acted in accordance with their agenda. So understanding motive and expressing it is terribly important to understanding what happened and believing whether it did happen. If you have action in a vacuum, it seems to lack credibility. The details that drive action and make it credible and believable tend to be motive and opportunity. All right? These are elements of all story. And now something about plot. I want you to be aware of this definition. I picked it out for you deliberately. We tend to think of what happens or the storyline and chronology and plot as interchangeable. The chronology is not the same as plot. Chronology is different. Chronology is the order in which things happen. Plot, according to Barnett, Berman, and Berto, a dictionary of literary terms, a plot is the sequence in which the author arranges the events. Now, you can't change the fact, but you can change the order in which you talk about the fact. And you can do this for the purpose of creating the inference of cause and effect. Folks, when you shape the case, you're writing a story, you're writing a plot. And how you articulate it makes all the difference in the world. You pick the facts out of all the facts that you're going to use, and you pick the facts that you're going to leave out, and you got to be careful on each. But you're the one that picks the facts, and you're the one that picks the order in which they're told, and you're the one that picks the order of the witnesses and how they're presented. And this is absolutely key.
This is the end of Tape 2, Side 1. The program continues on Side 2.
Okay, folks, we've talked about the elements of a story, but the advocate is just as concerned with qualities of good stories. And there are things that make a tremendous amount of difference that you might not focus on otherwise. Number one is, it is true. And this is why you will never, in an opening statement, talk about your story using the word story. Story theory is essential to what we're doing, but story is a bad word. Story's secondary connotations are, it is something that was made up. It is not true. Well, your story then is that you saw him three times. Is that right? You've heard that kind of question. And story is almost dripping with, we don't believe it. Story is a bad word. And if you reveal that the story you tell is not true or not wholly true, it's astonishing how cheated everybody will feel. Let me tell you a story about a story. An actor, Ken Alberts, who worked with the Professional Education Group for a number of years in a program that Jim Jeans and Ken Alberts and I did called Mastering the Craft of Trial Advocacy. Alberts used to talk about stories from an actor's perspective.
And to introduce his discussion about stories, he would tell a story. He said, I want to tell you a story. And it was about an airplane trip that he took, and he was seated next to an elderly woman with gray hair, and she was taking her first airplane ride, and she was frightened because she'd never flown before. And she got off the ground, white knuckles and saying prayers and all of that. And she was okay, and she talked to Albers during the time that they flew, and they discussed the fact that she was on her way to her grandson's graduation from college. And she was proud of the fact that her grandson had made it through college. She was going to see her son and her daughter-in-law and be with them at the graduation time. She was a widow and had lost her husband and only wished that her husband could be taking this trip with her. And then as they came into Minneapolis in this 727, she said to Albers, young man, will you hold my hand? I'm frightened by the landing. And so Ken Albers held this elderly woman's hand as the plane landed, and right as the flaps were going down and the plane kind of gave a little bump, her hand went limp. She died. Now, he told that story, and it's touching. And they said, of course, I just made this all up. And none of it's true. And the people were furious. Said, you toyed with our emotions. You played with us. How can you do something like that? You're phony. They were mad at him. And I talked to him later, and I said, Albers, and I talked to the audience about it. I said, were you guys annoyed? Yeah, we sure were. And in a way, you're almost annoyed with me now for repeating an untrue story. I confronted him with him, and I said, Albers, the story is true, isn't it? He said, yeah, it is. I just decided to take the edge off by telling him it wasn't true, but it was true. And now, in a sense, you feel vindicated for letting your emotions go with this because you find out that it actually was true, and she really did die. And he had the difficult job of waiting because the son and the grandson were there to greet the plane. And he had to tell the story to them, which he figured it was his job to do. And therefore, he kind of protected himself by denying it its truth. Well, all of this is by way of saying to you that the most important aspect of any story, anytime, whether it's a true story or a metaphysically true story, that is, one that's poetically true, but not physically actual truth, that's okay. I mean, in the parable of the Good Samaritan, does it really matter whether or not the traveler was beaten? Does it really matter whether a Samaritan came and actually helped him or not? The message is a wonderful message. That's poetic truth. But it had to be told as total, actual truth. Otherwise, it wouldn't be accepted, understood, and believed, and acted upon. So the number one quality for you is truth, and that relates to your credibility as a lawyer to begin with. Number two, it's got to be simple. People tend to make those stories very simple in their scripts, and they jump on the end of it right away. You got to be careful to get the important, essential elements in quickly, but at the same time, not to make it complex. When the story takes too long to tell and too long to understand, people cannot put off finishing it that long. And they'll finish it for you, and they may finish it wrongly. So you got to work very hard to make it simple and make it honest and simple. By simple, I don't mean simplistic. Truth is often simple. Untruth is simplistic. It's the unfair simplicity. You've got to work for simplicity and accuracy, which is elegant and gripping. Simplicity takes a long time. You've heard the old thing about, I'm sorry this letter was so long. If I had more time, it would have been shorter. You have to work hard to make the story simple. That's all there is to it. Show, don't tell. Avoid adjectives. Avoid adverbs. Avoid modifiers. They inject your opinion. Your opinion is suspect because they know you're an advocate. So you should show with facts rather than with adjectives and adverbs and modifiers, because you do not want to inject your opinion needlessly. When you inject your opinion, it's discounted. As long as you're a reliable recounter of facts, more likely to be trusted, or at least provisionally trusted until they hear the facts for themselves. All right. I want to demonstrate showing versus telling. And there's something I want to read you, so I'm going to go back here and get it. I've got the storyline written out for you. It's on the next page. It's about the bricklayer. Let me read you the storyline as it appears on page 17. And then let me show you the difference between showing and telling. Okay? Here's the story. A bricklayer fixed a building after a storm. He took more bricks up to the top of the building than he needed. He was hurt when he tried to lower the rest of the bricks back down. That's the story. Very simple. It doesn't mean a lot. Let me read you the letter from the bricklayer in Golders Green to a firm for which he worked. This was printed in the weekly bulletin of the Federation of Civil Engineering Contractors in Leicester, England. And I want to read to you verbatim the story that I have just read to you in shortened form with all of the essential facts. Well, most of the essential facts. Respected sir, when I got to the top of the building, I found the storm had knocked some bricks off the top. So I rigged up a beam and a pulley at the top of the building and hoisted up a couple of barrels full of bricks. When I had fixed the building, there was a lot of bricks left over. I hoisted the barrel up, back up again, and secured the line at the bottom, and then went up and filled the barrel with the extra bricks. Then I went down to the bottom and cast off the line. Unfortunately, the barrel of bricks was heavier than I was. And before I knew what was happening, the barrel started down, jerking me off the ground. I decided to hang on. Halfway up, I met the barrel coming down and received a severe blow on my shoulder. And I continued up to the top, banging me head against the beam and getting me fingers jammed in the pulley. When I hit the beam, the barrel hit the ground. When the barrel hit the ground, it burst at its bottom, allowing all the bricks to spill out. I was now heavier than the barrel. And so I started down again at high speed. Halfway down, I met the barrel coming and received severe injury to my shins. When I hit the ground, I landed on the bricks, getting several painful cuts from the sharp edges. At this point, I must have lost me presence of mind because I let go the line. The barrel then came down, giving me another heavy blow and putting me in hospital. I respectfully request sick leave. Truly yours, Gerard Hoffnos. Well, there's an amazing difference between showing and telling. And with the details of how it happened, you see it, don't you? You saw it. And you anticipated. You knew what was coming because the law of physics didn't change for the story. And you were waiting to hear it, and you knew that it had to happen. And you've read the story before, probably, because it's a lovely story. And that letter really was printed in that thing. And whether it was made up or not, I don't care. For my purposes, it's true, and I believe. Okay. Now then, another quality. A good story starts with a crisis. You want to grab their interest. If you don't want to grab their interest, start with neutral background. Oh, yeah. That's where it really gets exciting, with the neutral background that goes on for some time. Louis L'Amour. You know Louis L'Amour, the Western writer? He used to turn out novels that would start with a description of the land, how long the family had owned the ranch, and what it was like in that part of the country. And then he would have chapter two, the history of the family. And then chapter three, young Josh or Mike or Sam would be out gathering up some of the strays, and he would be riding back to the ranch when he saw the flames of the burning ranch. Then they had the crisis. Now, when Louis L'Amour wrote books that way, he was only moderately successful, and he didn't sell a lot of books. But when he learned, in his words, to write chapter three first, so that he started with the burning ranch, and he started with that gang of rustlers, who, incidentally, raped and abducted his sister and killed his parents, when he started with that crisis, and this guy whose horse is shot out from underneath him by the rustlers, who is crawling back over the desert to the ranch only to discover that it's in flame. When he started with the crisis, sales shot sky high. Start with the crisis. Why? It's the injustice. It's the unfairness that grabs people. Now, it's got to be understandable. And whether you start precisely with the crisis or with something else is going to depend upon your approach, and we're going to see some different approaches to that. Okay? Present facts when they become important. One of the awful things that lawyers tend to do is lay out all operative facts before they begin relating the events. And they list these facts as if, now, you got to understand all these, you got to have all these. If you don't have them in your mind, then you can't understand what's going on. And nobody can keep all that stuff straight. Nobody. Good writers do not confuse you as to who the actors are. The actors come into the story when they become important. You may learn some operative fact about them early on. They may be introduced in bits and pieces, but if done properly, those bits and pieces are timed to develop with your understanding of this person before you meet them. What I'm saying is, no good writers say, let me tell you all the people in this case. Nobody does that. Let me list all of the folks who are going to be players in this story, this novel, this play. I mean, you will not understand a Shakespeare play by reading the cast of characters. It is insane for you ever to do an opening statement that is a cast of character. When you describe what you're going to do during the course of the trial and promise which witnesses you're going to call and the order in which you're going to call them, you're making a mistake, not only because you might not call a witness and you've made a promise you won't keep, which is disaster, but also because nobody can figure out what the story is about from hearing who the actors are. And yet you hear lawyers, otherwise good lawyers, doing this all the time. And you don't want ever to do that. Present facts and characters when they become important. Never, however, leave a pivotal fact until it is already operated. When you give the pivotal fact after the fact, later, typically the audience feels cheated, as if you have just invented the pivotal fact. Now, if you leave out a pivotal fact for the purpose of calling attention to it, that's different. You might have an unexpected result, and now you say to the jury, and how could this happen? Obviously, there's something they didn't know. What was it? Now you're using it to heighten the tension. The only time you will take an operative fact out of its operative place is to heighten attention. If you discuss it or reveal it as an afterthought, it will look artificial and contrived. And you've all been annoyed by novels or novelists who do that to you. You say, oh, yeah, now, if we would have known that before. But they held it back, and you feel cheated. And the mystery writers who hold back the operative fact and pretend that you should have been able to figure something out without that operative fact, they're annoying. And the chances are you don't buy those again. Jury's going to treat you the same way. Be careful. Present facts when they become important, characters when they become operative. Tension. Tension is the collision between competing interests or motives, and tension creates interest because tension implies something's going to happen. People want to know what it is. All right. Suspense and foreshadowing. You stand up and you say, ladies and gentlemen, this is a case about a young woman's eyes. And you let that sink in for 10 seconds. And the jury knows, even if you haven't had a chance to talk to them in voir dire, the jury knows something happened to those eyes, and they don't know what, and they want to know. And they want to know what it was that happened and why it happened. And you have foreshadowed the crisis by saying this is a case about a young woman's eyes. Foreshadowing is hinting what's coming without nailing it down. If you milk it too much, you look cheap. If you don't milk it too much, it creates interest. A lot of art in how you foreshadow. Okay. You might explain to the jury that the plaintiff's condition is uncertain. And we have asked the doctor who evaluated Cindy at the Mayo Clinic to come here today to tell you what his professional evaluation is and what her chances are for walking. Now, they now know what the job of this witness is. You have not gone through purple prose about she'll never walk again. You want them to care and want to find out. And when this doctor from the Mayo Clinic shows up, they are focused already on the key information. Okay? Foreshadowing is one of the things that can be very effective. Motive for conduct, we've already talked about. And what happens has got to matter. Now, if it doesn't matter, you got no business having a lawsuit to begin with. But that what happens really does have to matter. It's astonishing to me how many lawsuits today seem the conduct. Maybe I really wonder whether this matters or whether we have too many hungry lawyers bringing kind of silly cases. And there's some of that going on, too. All right. What goes in the story and what doesn't go in the story? We're shaping the case. The motion in limine is terribly important. Alan Morrill and the water heater. Alan Morrill, a Chicago lawyer, now a Chicago judge, was representing a young man who was seriously injured by an exploding water heater. This water heater was in the basement of the Chicago home, and it exploded, and water heater shrapnel goes up through the floor, up through box springs, up through an inner spring mattress, up through the mattress cover, and embeds itself into the gluteus maximus of this young man, the plaintiff in the case. Now that's painful. When you've got water heater shrapnel buried in your rear end, you take some serious affront at what happened to you. So he sued the water heater manufacturer company and the manufacturer of the pressure relief valve that did not relieve the pressure, causing the water heater to explode. There is a fact that troubled the plaintiff that delighted the water heater company. And the fact was that the young man was in the wrong bed. He was not in his bed at home with his wife, but rather with a girlfriend. And it was her water heater that had exploded. And you can just see the water heater company grinning and rubbing their hands in delight. And you can just see them talking about, in final argument, how the Lord works in strange ways, his wonders to reveal, and how maybe there is poetic justice here on earth. Okay? Now then, if you got to wrestle with this fact, it is a very different story than if you don't have to wrestle with this fact. And so the plaintiff makes a motion in limine. A motion in limine, by the way, is not always a prohibitory motion. It is not always a negative motion. It is not always a motion to exclude. It can be a motion to admit. In limine is not a cognate for limitation. In limine means at the threshold. And it can be a motion to admit evidence. We rarely do it, but it's the law. You can do it. So he makes a motion in limine and it's granted. He shaped the case with the law of evidence. And you've got to do that. And you don't know how to play it until you get your ruling. Now you have a difficult choice to make. Suppose you're up against somebody who you don't think a lot of. Do they know about the fact he's in the wrong bed? Do you assume they know it? Or do you risk educating them and having the motion denied anyhow? You got tough choices to make. All I can say is err on the side of caution. When in doubt, bring it out. When in doubt, make the motion. Yeah, you may educate some opponents, but the chances are they're playing dumb and lying low. I know, just like plaintiff's lawyers don't mousetrap, defense lawyers don't lie low. Some of them do. Some of them do. I know some. What goes in the story and what stays out of the story, you've got to be careful. Number two, do you bring out your bad facts yourself? Or do you let the other side do it? Recently, there's been published a book by Colby and Klonoff called Sponsorship Strategy that suggests you ought to put your best foot forward. Well, of course, you should put your best foot forward. And that means leaving your bad foot out of it. Watch out, folks. If you create the impression with the jury that you have misled them by your omission and that they formed a false impression, that they formed the wrong story based on your omission, they will feel cheated by you. Do not assume that there are no risks in what Colby and Klonoff suggest. What I'm telling you is make your determination, and I say err on the side of bringing it out. When in doubt, bring it out. Sure, you've got some awkward facts to explain, but you will be applauded for your honesty. And when you conceal or appear to have concealed by omission. Facts that are damaging. If the jury thinks it was deliberate, and they probably will, it can cost you terribly. All right, we talked about being the guide. A couple of points. You got to believe in this theory of your case. If you don't believe in it, you're not going to sell it to anybody else. You can't sell what you don't buy. If you think that you've come here to learn how to pull the wool over jury's eyes, bag it, forget it. You can't. It's not going to work. Misleading is dangerous. Hedging is dangerous. Hedging. Oh, that's what we learned when we became lawyers. We engaged in aerobic hedging. We engage in creative hedging. We engage in dodging. And when we dodge and when we hedge and when we fail, simply and bravely and straightforwardly saying, this is it. You can hedge all day long in all of the negotiations you want. That's fine. When you're in front of a judge and jury, when you hedge, it costs terribly. It undercuts your credibility. Hedging's a bad habit. All right. Personifying the client. You got to personify it. You've got to take off the procedural mask. You're not representing a plaintiff. You're not representing a defendant. You're representing a real-life person. Or persons, or company. And you got to pick the details that show that humanity, and you've got to pick a representative who lives the theory of the case. And this afternoon, you're going to see how that can work in a particular instance. All right, there we have it.
This is the end of Tape 2, Side 2. The program continues on Tape 3.